Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. And because we are live today, I'd like to extend an invitation for those that are coming in on time. If you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that is where you will find the chat room. We've already got Paul and another half dozen guys in there already. If you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, or if there's a question you would like to direct to either one of us, that would be the great place to do it because we will monitor it during the course of the show. And this is our Melee format, so we have our ideas what we want to talk about and what we'll kick off with. But as always, we're interested to hear your questions as well. And if you don't have stage fright and you are so inclined, right there on the show page, you have the studio line. We have open phones, too. You're always welcome to call in. But we already did most of the show on the pre-show. I was just joking with my co-host. I was like, hey, we got to remember all these great points. So I guess we got to go back to point one, Eagle One, and kick up the conversation. Happy after Thanksgiving to you.
Oh, great. Thank you very much. And yeah, we need to get this going. There's a lot going on in the world all by the axis of evil, which the new axis of evil, Iran, China, and Russia. So we've got all their proxy forces in operation. What more could you ask for a show that deals with national defense issues?
And I guess if we're looking at what is on the above the fold, you know, let's go ahead and go down to the bottom of the Red Sea, the USS Kearney, for those that have been paying attention, evidently has had from the, as I like to say, you can't buy training like this. They had, back for those that remember back on the 19th of October, the USS Kearney, which for those that don't know, it's a Mayport-based Arleigh Burke Flight 1 destroyer, a crisp 27 years old, but they had a good extended shoot down on the 19th of October. And evidently, the last day, I've seen a couple reports saying that she had an extended five-hour engagement down there right off of the mouth of the Red Sea. And it went on for about 5 hours, going after both, evidently, not just reconnaissance drones coming from the Houthi rebels in Yemen, but there was a British flagship who has a distant connection. One of its co-owners of that company is an Israeli that evidently was hit by one of them. So it's been a great Navy day for the surface warfare community who's getting some good training.
Yeah, it's undoubtedly good training. I always worry that we're also training the Chinese ships, which are sitting off there, not participating in this action, although they're sure got to be capable of it. But they're certainly going to be learning some good lessons from us, which may they'll put into their knowledge bin and call on it later if they feel the need.
And I think it's important as people hear things that are, you see Houthi up there, you see what's happening in the Red Sea, you're wondering why we're firing missiles and whatever else we're shooting at them to shoot them down. Why? Part of it is that's what we do as part of enforcing the international world order. But everybody needs to keep in the back of their head the Houthis aren't doing this for their own good. Yeah, they've taken pot shots at us a few years ago. The USS Mason took down some stuff that was actually fired at them. We think some of these missiles that was shot down were actually headed for Israel's towns. Some of them are heading for the ships. We've had some ships hit. We've had the Houthis seize some ships. We've broken it out. But it is all happening because of their sponsorship by Iran. And I think that's the real challenge for decision makers, is to make sure that we understand why the Houthis are doing this, So, and maybe what they want is what they deserve and maybe they should get, but it's a big challenge to try to figure out how we should respond to this. And another thing that, that just off the top of my head that we mentioned in the pre-show, I may have wanted to bring up, I want to pull out one of my, my dusty old hobby horses, is we've heard for the last, really since Mike Mullen was CNO, the idea of the thousand ship Navy. And yeah, we don't have frigates, but our allies do. We don't have enough surface ships, but that's okay because our allies could come with us. And we, you know, you look at CTF-151, where one of the Japanese ships supposedly helped during that hijacking. But when you look at who is doing the shooting down of the Houthi missiles, it's either headed for Israel or headed for international shipping in the Red Sea. It is the United States Navy. And if you're somebody who, regardless of your nationality or political stance, if you are interested in maintaining the international order that's existed since the end of World War II, you have to realize that that begins and ends on the high seas, and there is nobody who is going to be able to help enforce that that's not the United States Navy or led by the United States Navy. And it's just another one of those data points when you're trying to make discussions with people. And I'd be very interested to see what the insurance rates are for various companies trying to go through the Red Sea, because I think it's clear that the Houthis, via the Iranians, have a pretty good intel network of what ships are there and which ones have an Israeli or an American connection that they can go make a point, whatever that point is.
Yeah, it's, you know, in addition to everything else, it's not, I don't think it's that hard to find out that information in open source materials. I mean, it's not, it hasn't been a great big secret who owns these things. They're, but, you know, in the convoluted world of merchant shipping, it's so remote. You know, you may own a ship, but the ships are belong to a, you lease them or whatever, to an organization that puts their name on them, and your ownership is not really involved with it except basically collecting rent on those ships, while the operating company is the one that has to worry about profits and losses. But, you know, that just is another, like, it's like flag of convenience, another one of those twists and turns in this in the merchant shipping business. The for those who are interested, there was a really good article or a piece written in the by the Center of Strategic and International Studies back in 2019 on the Iran's proxy war, and it's a little dated because it's 2019. But if you want to know who the Houthis are and all that stuff, then it's a good piece. I'll put a link up in the chat room, and but you know, it's pretty clear that Tehran is, they've got the Houthis, they've got, and they're fighting with Saudi Arabia in a proxy war. They've got the Hezbollah in Lebanon, and they've got a whole bunch of other folks, and they really want that land routes, some land routes to get to the Mediterranean. And it's an interesting an interesting time to be alive.
Yeah, I know there was in the present administration, there was some people who had a theory that if we're nice to the Houthis and we try to reengage with the Iranians, that things will get better. Or the real cynical people said that they want the Iran deal because they want to have the Iran deal because they want to have the Iran deal back from the Obama administration. But either way, it just plain, it didn't work out at all. And hey, one great thing about our melees and free-for-all formats is we get nice surprises. And we've got a caller in here that I know is going to be a favorite for those on Midrats. Been coming here for years, and it's always great to have him on board. Mark Vandroff, hey, good afternoon. Thanks for calling in.
Good afternoon, Sal. Good afternoon, Eagle. How are you guys doing today?
Well, we're having, well, at least where I am, it's nice and hot and humid, as it always is. But you know how this part of a year is after Thanksgiving. It can be cold, or it could be April for the rest of the year. But yeah, we're doing well. So are you up north with your charges, or are you back home in the Mid Atlantic?
Back in the Middle Atlantic just for the weekend. I'm back on a plane to points further north tomorrow morning for a few weeks. The trouble with shipbuilding, that never stops being. So gotta get back up to work and make more progress. I'm glad that you guys are talking about the goings on in the Red Sea and down there at the southern end. And I'm going to do something that, for once, I'm glad I can heap some praise. I would direct you and any of your listeners to the U.S. Central Command official Twitter or X or whatever we're calling it now feed. They actually put out today an excellent, as they say in newspeak, TikTok, but they put out a hour-by-hour timeline of what the Carney was involved in, and it's actually a little more than 5 hours. As I clocked the TikTok, it was almost 8 hours of what can only be described as combat, shuttling between two different ships, providing aid to two different ships that had been attacked and were in various, looks like one was damaged, the other was undamaged. I just can't everyone read it. And during all of that, having to periodically shoot down missiles or drones that were headed in the Carney's general direction. And, you know, it was about 8 straight hours of maritime combat that the Carney was involved in. And CENTCOM laid it all out pretty well for a general audience in their Twitter feed. So I commend them for the transparency, and I commend Central Command for putting that out there. It's also been retweeted by Fifth Fleet. So either of those two Twitter feeds people can go to and take a look and see what Carney did. You made me feel very old when you said Carney was a 27-year-old destroyer, because I distinctly remember being at Troop Ship Bath while it was being built. So it still seems new to me, although that was almost 30 years ago that was going on. So. I felt a little old. I guess Carney's a little old. I'm feeling a little old. I am glad to have the chance to talk a little bit about the Houthis. That was a subject that I touched upon during my year at the National Security Council.
Well, talk a little bit about it. It's I put up a link to that CENTCOM report at Twitter, or X. But talk a little bit about the Houthis, because I don't think many people quite understand who the heck these folks are and what's going on with what they're trying to do in the Red Sea area.
Yeah, so Yemen, like a lot of countries that have governance issues, much like in Lebanon, you have an official government of Lebanon that doesn't control very much of the country, and then you have Hezbollah, which is a terrorist organization that controls a good chunk of the country. Internationally recognized government of Yemen doesn't have a lot of control over the territory of Yemen. They have control over part of it. And then there's a couple of other groups. Probably the Houthis now have control over the largest part of the populated part of the country. They are absolutely a client organization of the Iranians. Like the Iranians, they are Shia, not Sunni. They are ethnically Arab, so there is a friction point there between the Houthis and their Persian paymasters, but not much. I would say that the Houthis are a case study and should be studied from now on by people who are really interested in being serious about national security. That if you let problems fester, they don't get better on their own. The Houthis controlled less territory. They had less capability. They were less of a problem 5, 6, 7 years ago. And the governments of the UAE and Saudi Arabia were fairly effectively fighting a counterinsurgency against them on the side of the recognized Yemeni government. And the entire international community, and we are not, we were part of that. We, the United States of America, part of that, kept putting more and more pressure on the Saudis and the UAE to ease up. Because the Houthis, not unlike Hamas, were very good at putting civilians in between themselves and the military forces of the UAE and the Saudis. And the UAE and the Saudis were, frankly, not as good as the Israelis at attacking military forces without causing civilian damage and civilian death. So the humanitarian crisis was quite severe, and the lesson, what the international community did was put pressure not on someone to end it quickly so that they could get to a better place for the Yemeni people, but to simply stop, have Saudis and the Emiratis stop fighting. And in fact, the Emiratis were very sensitive about that. They, when they stopped, they wanted it to be known that they were all the way out of Yemen because they just didn't like the international heat anymore. If you're the Emiratis, you depend on both the oil-rich country, but now they depend a lot on international business and the willingness of other people to do international business in Dubai and Abu Dhabi that helps generate the considerable wealth of that country. So they didn't want to run afoul of the Europeans. They didn't want to run afoul of the Americans, and basically they let the problem fester. And now you have a first-class problem in the Red Sea because the Bab al-Mandeb is one of the world's primary choke points. A very significant chunk of the world's wealth flows through that narrow passage on its way to or from the Suez Canal, and now you have a very irresponsible actor who is going to take action on a timeline that they and their Iranian paymasters see fit to affect the flow of trade through that strait. And now it's going to take much more significant military action now than it would have taken 5, 6, 7 years ago if we just let the Saudis and the Emiratis continue their counterinsurgency. You wouldn't have that problem right now. So people, the national security professionals, need to understand that as painful as something might be in the short term, it is always, it's not always, but at least nothing's always in the realm of national security, but it's usually better to take some short-term pain rather for a long-term stability. Things will be better in the long term, and there will ultimately be less human suffering, even if it seems like there's a level of human suffering that you might find intolerable in the short term. To rid a region, to neutralize a bad actor, you will ultimately minimize the long-term amount of human suffering. Because right now there's about to be a lot of human suffering in Yemen. If the Houthis continue to do what they're doing, I don't know how the United States, the United Kingdom, other powers that are interested in the world don't start a significant military campaign to keep that strait open. Just economically, it's not viable. So that is where we are headed if something doesn't change.
Yeah, that's one of the two things. There's a third thing I wanted to bounce off you, Mark. You know, the first thing is, and history is replete with people making 180-degree turns, you know, the old only Nixon can go to China type of thing, but a lot of the senior appointees in the national security arena for this administration, they have a agenda that they are trying to pursue with Iran that is just a series of rakes to keep stepping on. You know, eventually, maybe it'll be too much. But, you know, you brought up the fact that the international community, regardless of what they may think of Iran and what's going on in Gaza, these economies, they need those straits open in an economic manner. You know, what is the pain threshold here? Because we do have a few thousand years of records of how to deal with pirate nests, if you want to look at it like that, the way they're behaving. But there's a larger issue that we were talking about in the pre-show that, regardless of where this is and who the players are, and we've had it go too long, you know, what what is the impact of the precedents we're setting that, okay, if you take pot shots at U.S. Navy warships in international waters, as long as we shoot the missile down, you know, no harm, no foul, maybe you'll have better luck next time, is you establish habits, you establish norms and what's expected. And how much longer can we expect to just allow people to lob missiles at our ships and not having a significant retaliation to make a point, not just to them, but to the next bad actor 6 months down the road? Because eventually something will get through. And when you have a ship that carries over 200 Americans, and we know how these things can work, if you take a bad hit, look what happened to the Russian cruiser in the Black Sea. That's a lot of families that are going to be asking why.
That's unquestionably true. And you need look no further than current modern Israel for your example there. Somehow the Israelis got used to having rockets come at them every so often. I mean, I don't know if you would feel okay where, hey, we're going to live our lives and we have a pretty good surface-to-air missile defense, but, you know, every few weeks, siren's going to go off, we're going to go run to a strong room in our basement, and we're going to consider that normal for several years, and eventually we'll just deal with it because to end it seems too hard, there'd be too much international outcry, we're going to have to cause a lot of suffering that, frankly, we don't want to cause because we'd rather not inflict the kind of response that would fix the problem because of the collateral damage. And frankly, we don't want to do that in Yemen, and I'm sure the Israelis don't want to do that in Gaza. And if you keep with the, I'll hope that the problem gets better, or I'll learn to live with it. The problem never gets better. The problems need to be fixed, or they get worse. That is a repeated lesson of history. Everyone likes these days, and I don't know, it's a great analogy, but people talk about the 30s and Nazi Germany, and that was, but the lesson was the problem didn't get better. It got bad, and then fixing it was a world war that almost destroyed modern civilization in the end. Completely upended the world to where it took decades to recover from World War II, if you look at the world economy and it just changed the world. In some ways, perhaps for the better, certainly for the United States, we benefited from the post-World War II world order. But that was a tremendous price to pay for not taking a threat seriously early because it just seemed too hard to have to go deal with it in a serious way. And that's where we're at now. We have not dealt with this in a serious way. The counterpoint to that, and I was in a conversation with some folks over the Thanksgiving dinner table, and they challenged me to try and make the Obama-Biden foreign policy case for them. And I was like, you understand, I'm a critic of that. I'm not an advocate. And they said, yes, but everyone has a point. Can you put on your debating hat and articulate the other side? And I said, if I was trying hard, I would come up with a point that I think is a legitimate point. The Iranian people are not the Iranian government. And it seems like the United States should be able to have a reasonably productive relationship with Iran because we actually do have a lot of common interests, and their population is generally favorable towards America. And if you credit the Iranian government, meaning the mullahs of the IRGC, if you credit them with more rationality than I believe they actually have, you might be able to talk yourself into, well, if we address their legitimate security concerns, they'll be addressed, and that's, you know, then they will change their behavior. I don't know how my critique of that then to be, I just think that the history of the last, well, basically since the Iranian Revolution in 79, but certainly the last 10 to 15 years, shows that you can't credit the Iranian leadership, and especially the IRGC, with a Western level of irrationality. They are motivated by what motivates them, but that's, you know, that is not easily reconcilable with what we would consider legitimate security concerns. They are an expansionist power. They want to dominate the Middle East. They are viciously and virulently anti-Zionist and anti-Semitic. So they would be happy to wipe Israel off the map and kill as many Jews as possible. And that is their strategic goal. That's what victory looks like to Iran. So the idea that we can address that, it's not like, well, you know, make sure that they're in a position where the Sunni Muslim states can't violate their territorial integrity, and they'll say, good, now I'm happy, we can stop. That's not where they're at. And I think anyone who thinks that they can be accommodated has an incorrect understanding of their regime.
I think you'd be impressed that former Obama Secretary of Defense and CIA Director did say the other day that the U.S. should respond to the increasing number of attacks by Iran's proxy groups. And he said, I would be much more aggressive. I want to go after those who are firing missiles at our troops, make sure they understand when they fire a missile, they're going to die. And this is, he was referring to the troops in Iraq and Syria,
Iraq.
I guess.
I read Secretary Panetta's remarks. I even retweeted them with great approval. I believe Secretary Panetta is seeing the world clearly when he said that.
Yeah, I think, you know, there is out there, everybody always likes to talk about the bipartisan consensus. I think especially the events of October 7th, it's been clarifying in a lot of ways, and it's making people perhaps throw away a few assumptions. If they're on the fence, push them one side or the other. But you know what you can realistically accomplish with Iran versus what the Iranians are willing to accomplish, there's a big delta there. And after a while, people will continue to signal to you what they want to do. And if you look what the situation that we've been discussing in the Red Sea, and you look at the medieval activity that Hamas kicked off on the 7th of October, both of those are inside of the Iranian leadership's plan, whatever that ultimate plan is. None of that seems aligned with a rapprochement or trying to move to a more settled situation, just the opposite. You try to get in the head of the Iranians using the Houthis. I guess there's an outside chance that the Houthis are just doing what Houthis do, but there's a larger chance that they would really like somehow to get the United States to get involved, to raise the temperature more, which is why earlier on the show I mentioned, is there an overlap between what they want and really what they deserve? And I know there is a lot in our toolkit. And for decision makers, they've just got to rack and stack whatever the higher intentions and direction and guidance are, what, if any, response we can do. But I think one of the worst things that could happen to us is we wind up having Americans killed or captured in the process. But we have a lot of tools in our toolbox that we can make our point rather firmly, risk not much more than how we're operating today. Of course, the second, third order effects from what we do and how we do it can be interesting. But one thing about these missiles and these drones that they have, even though last decade Hezbollah in Lebanon did surprise an Israeli SAR Corvette with a old Chinese version of the
C-802.
C-802. But we have to know where these things are roughly located, that we could at least affect their inventory for a change.
Oh, absolutely. That gets back into, now we have the Israel problem, because all of the Houthi, their drone storage facilities are all in towns, populated towns with civilians. All of their launch points for their surface-to-surface and surface-to-ship ballistic missiles, when they go to set them up, they set them up next to schools and mosques and medical facilities. They're not out in an open field there. So you want to hit them with Tomahawks. You want to hit them with land attack missiles coming off of an F-15. You want to fly in there with an F-35 coming out of, talk to the Emiratis, your favorite F-35 coming out of Al Dhafra and putting some ordnance on that target, once they start with the missiles. There's going to be a civilian body count. And then the question is, who are we to criticize Israel and tell them, we need you guys to be very careful when it's our operation, we're putting civilians at risk too. But if the Houthis keep putting missiles into the Red Sea, at what point does that price have to be paid? And that's a dilemma that we're going to be facing soon, and potentially we could be facing soon. There's no question that the Houthi capability is not easily concealed, right? In that they all of those missile sites, all of their launch points, all of their storage for their drones, those are not easy to conceal. Between our airborne intelligence, our satellite intelligence, it's not that we can't target them. It's that targeting them will bring a significant risk of civilian collateral damage. And then the question is that a price that we're willing to pay?
Well, that's the during the Gulf War, we talked about the CNN effect. Now we're talking about everybody in the world with a cell phone camera showing whatever they see and putting it immediately on the Internet, which, is the CNN effect writ large. It is a challenge to demonstrate that the problem that you've solved by eliminating one of these sites that happens to be next to a school was worth that effort, and that we've made every effort not to target civilians. But that is an issue that I think is a lot of trouble for us. The other issue I have is we're spending a lot of money on, and this somebody just put this up in our chat room, a lot of money on the weaponry used to shoot down these some slow flying drones and some other systems that I just keep thinking we must have some cheaper alternative that we could put in the air to take out some of these things without expenditure of a few $100,000 missile or something like that. But you got any thoughts along those lines?
Yeah, you should have Brian McGrath on for that talk. I mean, I have thoughts, but I think Brian's thoughts are, if not better than mine. I mean, he's spent more time operating warships at sea. I buy stuff and I build stuff, but Brian spent more time operating. And he makes the point and has publicly on his Twitter feed and his blogs at least at this point, your risk calculation is not one where you not want to employ your full defense in depth. Frankly, I think we're probably, and I have no inside knowledge, so I'm going on very sketchy public reporting because we don't know all of what's been engaged. The Navy and the Pentagon has not put out that level of detail. But assuming we're using SM-2s to take out a lot of these targets, so we're doing that at range, a lot of these drone targets would be very easily engageable on a DDG-51 by a 5-inch 54 using the appropriate frag rounds to do that. But now you're engaging them at a much shorter range, and you're going to get fewer shots off. And if you're a CO out there right now, if you're on Kearney, if you're on Mason, if you're on Hudner, you're probably not too worried about what the exchange rate looks like over a long term and over the dollars and cents. What you're looking at is, I can't take a hit. So as soon as I see something that I'm determining as a threat, I'm going to take a shot with the longest range weapon that I have currently in my inventory. I'm not going to wait with the idea of saying, this guy's not that much of a threat. I have a good high confidence kill with a 5-inch 54. So instead of using a $500,000 or $600,000 surface air missile, I'll use an $8,000 frag round out of a a 5-inch or whatever 5-inch rounds cost these days, and take that out. But I'm going to wait a long time. It's just, I don't think that that at this point anyone's got that as part of their calculation. I think once they've determined that something is a threat, then they're going to go after that. As far as the short-range ballistic missile, that is a completely different when it comes to weapon selection. Kearney probably has a few of its surface-to-air missiles, some of the versions of the SM-2, the SM-3 that it's carrying, that are specifically designed for the ballistic missile threat, and that's what they're going to use against that threat. But against cruise missiles and UAVs, which frankly are the same kind of threat, the only difference is a little bit of speed and what do you call them. But again, it's the same kind of threat. I think that they're going to use an SM-2 just because they don't want it to get close, and they don't want to take the risk of something getting close at this point. The geostrategic consequences of a U.S. Navy destroyer taking a hit right now would be very high. And so if I'm this fleet or if I'm CENTCOM, I'm calling up every one of those ship captains and having a personal discussion with them and saying, whatever you do, do not take a hit.
Yeah, I think that's clear. You know, you go Winchester and then you just leave because the repercussions of taking a hit. And you know, how long can we rope-a-dope this with one thing we talked about before everything kicked off here is the fact that we don't have to convince you or most of the listeners here that we don't have the size of the Navy we have. And especially when you are forward deployed like that, and who knows what the mix is in those VLS cells, but you can't do it for a long time. And the Houthis, they're not producing these themselves. At least I think they might do some local production of some really low-end stuff. But this stuff is getting to them from Iran. And occasionally we've intercepted their merchant ships and stuff.
Yeah, go back to the press releases. You know, I mean, for the last 5 years, you can go with release, I think, the U.S. Navy and other allied navies have intercepted weapons being smuggled into Yemen for the Houthis by the Iranians on a pretty regular basis. And that's just the stuff that stopped. So you have to assume that if you're stopping a fair amount of stuff must be getting through. But, I mean, just go back to Central Command's press releases for the last 3 or 4 years, and you'll see plenty of press releases of Aegis cruisers, Aegis destroyers, various allied ships, some of the U.S. Coast Guard ships that are operating over in the 5th Fleet AOR, all of which were just laid out on their flight deck of rockets, rocket parts, Kalashnikovs, RPGs, surface-to-air missiles, the whole gamut laid out on a flight deck being inventoried because we found dows and other non-traditional methods smuggling that, and the source for all of that was Iran.
And I don't know how many more ships it would take. And if you could get any of our allies who would be willing to do something tight like that, and we'd have to get anybody know a good admiralty lawyer. But you'd also have to look, what can you do against the Houthi, which is they're not a nation. They're a rebel organization who's acting in a piratical manner. I would be very interested to see what additional steps you could take without – you can't preach the international order if you're violating it all the time. But there has to be some additional options we could take. But until people decide that that's not going to interfere with larger things they want to do with Iran treaty-wise, I guess we just have to keep being pretty damn good at knocking things out of the air.
Yeah, I'll tell you, if anyone issues you, Sal, a letter of mark, right, and you find yourself with a vessel, give me a call. I'll sign up. I'll be one of Salamander's privateers.
Yeah, under international law of war, these Houthis who are not a uniformed service but are engaging in activities like this, I think they're fair game. I don't think there's any restriction on what you can do to people who are shooting at you. You've got there is a law of self-defense, and I think that includes the right to take out the source of the things that are attacking you. So I'd have to go back and look at it, but I think they're fair game. I think they're sort of like, as you've said, they're pirates, although they're pirate-like, but they're on shore, and they remind me of some of the other questions we've had about dealing with insurgent forces.
A lot of people are getting, you know, the international law isn't what it used to be. Apparently, under international law, if you're a belligerent, you have a responsibility to provide the other belligerent with power and utilities, lest it be considered a war crime to not provide the other belligerent. And that I was trying to find that in any of the Geneva Conventions or the Hague Conventions. I somehow couldn't. I missed it. But there were many people in my Twitter feed that were insisting that that somehow a belligerent has a responsibility to provide the belligerents on the opposite party with utilities, lest it be a war crime. Ken Roth, the head of Amnesty International, is very insistent on that, and he has to be an expert on international humanitarian law. It can't just be that he's a Jew-hating scumbag and is applying that only to Israel. I'm sure he's better than that, but I don't understand. So I would say under international law, sure, we would have a right to prevent the Houthis from taking the action that they are, but who can tell what international law is anymore if, you know, after the discussions we have about it on Twitter?
Yeah, there's it's been a wonderfully clarifying event, or a sadly clarifying event, depending on how you want to look at it, with a lot of policymakers in the West. They don't have as much pull in the rest of the world unless it's fully aligned with them. A lot of these international organizations that have been around for a long time, and you know, we're gentlemen of a certain age. We remember they weren't real supportive of the free world during the Cold War. They were very selective there. But, you know, there are a few realities that people are going to have to start pushing back on. For instance, the Army talks a lot about urban war, and, you know, we need to, and I think we've talked about it a few years ago here on the show, that the challenges of the urban landscape in the coastal environment is very, very real. It's also very, very real if you have an enemy who is, as you said, launching their missiles next to schools, mosques, you know, clinics, kindergartens. There is a certain point that we have to look back at the history of warfare. A couple of things. When we had to take out ball-bearing plants in Schweinfurt, we didn't mean to take out the schools and the hospitals that are three blocks away, but, you know, that's just the way war is. And if you are fighting an enemy who is killing you, killing your children, raping your wives, and they are hiding inside of hospitals and shooting at you, that's a different set of requirements that people are going to have to just learn. This is what we're going to do. You can take, you know, precision weapons and do the best you can do so, but I'm comfortable saying you're under no moral obligation to allow your enemy to use your virtue against you in an existential battle that certain people are going to be fighting. How you start that conversation, I don't know, but a lot of it would be not responding to certain international organizations who feel like they can put out a press release and have spokesmen go up to the podium and try to talk around it or apologize. I'm waiting to see that movement take place in higher echelons of areas, but there's a window there if people want to speak correctly and speak realistically about what we're looking at. And as the Gaza operation goes, another truth that I found very frustrating, a lot of the people wearing the white hats are doing it as well. One thing that's been constant throughout all human written history: in a war, when there is an urban area under siege or in conflict, all supplies that come in, water, food, medical, it goes to the garrison first. So all these trucks that are coming across the Egyptian border for, quote, humanitarian aid, that's just not going to the non-combatants, whatever that is in Gaza. It's going to take care of the garrison first. And that's going to extend this conflict longer, which if you really wanted to be a dark-minded person, that's why the hostages were taken. They played this out pretty well. They're going to play our virtue against us, our being the non-Hamas sorting part of the planet. They know that there's a lack of patience, and there's a lot of people who they can't be discussed with reasons and hard facts. They're just very, very emotional, and it's worked in the past, and it's kind of working in certain areas right now. Hopefully we'll have leaders that will have the spine that you need at times like this.
Yeah, it helps to take the long view. Since we're in the Christmas season, I actually thought about the seventh chapter of the book of Isaiah, which I know that there's lines in there that people of the Christian faith would view as being prophetic of the birth of Jesus some 700 years after it was written. But if you read the entire chapter, when Isaiah looks at the king and says, you know, behold, this young woman will be with child, and that, you know, the people will call, she will call his name, God is with us. The rest of that is the sign that says, and, you know, before he knows to speak, you know, knows what is the difference between good and evil, he will be eating cream and butter. The historical context around that, when you read that in context with the Book of Chronicles, the Book of Kings, is Jerusalem was under siege, right? I mean, and the people were starving, and the king was losing faith, and Isaiah was telling him, listen, this child will have food to eat when it is born, because God will deliver us from this siege. That was the point that Isaiah was making to the king in saying that. And you're exactly right. The kid would have been the last one to get fed in whatever they had, because they needed food for the soldiers to keep the siege. Because that would mean that the siege is over, and that was the sign that Isaiah was promising the king from God, is that the kid would be able to eat rich food, because that therefore the siege would be over. And because in a siege, you don't feed the kids. And we have that's 2,700 years ago, and in many ways no less true today.
Yeah, I look at some of this situation. I'm wondering where our European allies are. I mean, and specifically with the Red Sea, where is France? Where is Spain? Where is Italy? Where is the UK? Where are the Germans? I mean, I know they did their anti-piracy patrols, but they're, you know, we're not the ones, although we use a lot of Middle East oil, we're not the ones who are totally dependent on Middle East oil like some of the countries I just rolled through. So, you know, back in the days we had that concept of a 1,000-ship navy, and we've got all these allies. Where the heck are they, and why are they not assisting in the thwarting of the ill doings of the Houthis and keeping the Red Sea and the Suez Canal open? Because I mean, last time this went through this kind of shindig, 1967, that the Suez Canal was closed for 8 years. I don't think we want to go through that again.
No, in fact, a great idea for a show, the two people to debate what, you know, the Europeans are doing, should be doing, and how we should be engaging with them. You should have a host of Midrats conversation with Bridge Colby and Corey Shockey. Get the two of them together and have a two serious thinkers with two very different views on what the role of the U.S. vis-a-vis the European or European allies is and should be. You'd have a great show there. I'd listen to that over and over again.
We'll write that down. Let's see.
Take that good notes. The one thing that kind of along the the same lines of when we were talking earlier about, you know, we always have this conversation that trying to explain, you know, this is a time where you need more ships. We don't have enough Navy. I mean, we've talked about that over and over again. And I saw something that just it kind of knocked me back, because before you can have that conversation, you've got to have an audience that has some open ears. And kind of a change of the topic here for a bit, but I don't know if you saw, Ben Coleman was out at the Ronald Reagan National Security, and he took a screenshot of the fate in various institutions. And it was one on the slide, in addition to, let's see what we have here. We've got the presidency, Supreme Court, everything else. You also have the U.S. military. And if you look at 2018, the U.S. military had a 70% confidence in, and now we're down to 46%. It's been a larger drop than any of those other institutions. All the institutions that people have less faith in, but the military has had the most drastic drop. When you're up high, you can go down pretty far. Is that, as we go forward in the next few years, as we try to use examples like what we have in the Red Sea, not just talking to our allies to do more, but talking to the American public and their representatives about, hey, this is why this is serious. How do you like to buy these imports? How would you like to pay two times for them? The whole economic tie-in and the fact that these things don't magically happen. In a world full of bad faith actors, you have to have good faith actors with forces willing to stand up to them, or you just, like we've lost most of the South China Sea because a bad faith actor went in there and said, this is mine, do something about it. Eventually, we go back to a 18th and 17th century world where some parts of the ocean you just don't go in. What are your thoughts, one, about why that has fallen so fast? And is that something that will be part of the headwinds we have to try to explain why our Navy needs to be stronger and why naval power needs to be a more important part of our national security investments?
Yeah, I saw that slide from the Reagan Defense Forum. One, I think we're caught up in institutions losing their credibility. Part of that is we need better institutions. Part of that is we have and I hate, so there's so much bad information out there. And so the impulse of many is we have to regulate the information flow. And that will only make the problem worse. You know, yes, there's a lot of garbage on social media, but a lot of people will take a look at it and make it seem truthful. And then it's like, well, we have to regulate to make sure that there's not disinformation out there. I think that within the United States, I mean, I'm a big believer in banning TikTok because that's a foreign influence operation. But for American social media companies, I think that more information, clearer information is the best antidote to that. And frankly, institutions need to learn how to communicate their own effectiveness and work. That's part of the mission set. DOD and the military is not good at that anymore. We used to be better at it, and we're not good at it anymore. And we or they, I still maybe occasionally think of myself as part of an organization I've retired from. They need to learn to adapt and overcome and be able to communicate effectively with the people whose support that they need. And they're not doing that. And if you can't describe to people why what you're doing is relevant to their life, then don't expect them to care about it, because people got lots of things to care about. And that's just the way, that's the way the cookie crumbles. There's less people in the general population with military experience. And frankly, more and more people view what goes on overseas as not connected to them, and they wish that there was just that they could deal with less of it. And I fully understand that impulse. But what responsible people need to be able to communicate is that what happens overseas will ultimately affect the lives of the American people. To the degree that something's going on overseas that isn't going to affect the lives of American people, then I think we need to be less engaged in that. There's a lot of do-gooderism that has made up U.S. policy over, you know, certainly the 20th into the 21st century, ebbs and flows at various times. And if it's not going to directly affect the way the American people live their lives, then, you know, maybe the right answer is we're just going to be less interested in that. We're going to commit not so many resources to that. That's part of the argument with going on now with support for Ukraine. I think that what happens in Ukraine will matter to the average American sooner or later, and therefore I'm comfortable that we need to continue to commit resources to avoid Ukraine from falling to Russian aggression. But that's got to get explained, and it's the how and the why need to get tied together, which is something that I understand isn't getting done real well. So I understand people who are skeptical about making that connection. Again, you know, a guy like Bridge Colby has written eloquently about the Indo-PACOM and why we need to care, because it will affect the way Americans lead their lives if that goes in a south direction. But if we don't make the case of why things overseas affect how people live their lives in the United States, then they're going to be right not to care.
Yeah, I think we need some good insurance salesman talk about how the U.S. Navy has an insurance policy for the country. And we need some clever advertising to get that out to the public. I don't think we do a very good job. But one of the other questions I have for you is if given the number of ships we have, apparently we have two DDGs on pretty much in or near the Red Sea right now. And, you know, they're both firing off their weaponry. Where are we going to – do we have enough DDs to keep cycling a couple of these things in and out if their other job is to provide escort duties for the carriers we've got in the region?
Good question. I'm not – I don't do global force management anymore. So.
Oh, darn. You should know anyway.
That was one of the nice things about my year on the National Security Council staff was that – every morning, all the service chiefs get a brief, a set of PowerPoint slides of where all of their forces are all over the world. So the Navy has one, the Air Force has one, Marine Corps. It was just getting stood up for Space Force as I was there. And then there's kind of an overall synopsis that the chairman gets. And those intel briefs that are geared towards each service and then what's going on and then what the laydown is and the blue and the red. I had, because of what the job I had at NSC, I was on everyone's distribution for that. So the first thing I would do when I would turn on my computer and boot up JWICS is I would see where all of our deployed forces were across every service across, you know, all over the world. And that kind of gave me something to frame my day with. I haven't had that since, you know, December of 2020. So I'm 3 years and change out of date on that. So I don't know. I just know what the U.S. I follow the DOD and its COCOM's press releases on my Twitter feed. That's why I was so happy that Central Command put out a good, solid information timeline for what's going on with Carney. There have been reports of the Hudner, which is one of the newer DDGs, and the Mason, which is one of the early Flight 2As, 87, have had reports of them in the area of the Red Sea and engaged in different activities vis-a-vis the Houthis since October 7th. So I've read about those three ships, but I don't know where we might have additional missiles staged for reload. I don't know where we might have additional DDGs, either in the 5th Fleet or 6th Fleet AOR, that could come in and out and swap through them. I don't do global force management anymore, so I hope we've got the resources to keep the presence on station for as long as we need to to keep that choke point open. You have to ask someone else for the details of that.
Well, you just made me feel bad because now I miss JWIX too, but it's been 14 years for me. But you're right. That's a great way to start your morning. Just kind of peek behind the curtain and see what the world's greatest Navy is doing. Mark, it's the top of the hour. We really appreciate you coming in and joining us here. I know you've got a legit, really good paying gig coming up. Just for the listeners, what are some of the great things you can tell them to look forward to with your baby as we look forward to her commissioning?
So we've got next year at Think Tank Three Men at Marine, we're going to deliver the last three of the LCSs. I know that's a program that you have many opinions on, and I'll just say we've got acceptance trials on Nantucket next week. That's one of the things I'm going back for. As soon as the ice melts on the Great Lakes, we should be doing trials on Beloit and Cleveland, and then we will be done with LCS. And what they do...
Oh, for some reason we just lost Mark. Well, Mark, we got a bit, and we thank you very much for joining us. Eagle One, you have anything for our listeners before we close it down?
No, I want to thank Mark for coming on, and I thank the people who listened to us today, and thanks for all the great comments in the chat room. It's been very educational. You guys are always teaching us new stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate everybody that does come in the chat room. It's good to see Miss Boston Maggie there as well, and I thank everybody for joining us for another edition of Midrats, and I hope everybody has a safe and joyous holiday season and going through to the new year's. And until next time, I hope y'all have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.